Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started with the session today. My name is Carolina Bárcenas, and I am the Vice President for Data Science and Artificial Intelligence at Visa. And I'm going to be your... Thank you. I'm going to be your Master of Ceremonies for this session today. I'm really thrilled to be here supporting the advancement of women leaders across the state and in Austin. And gender diversity and inclusion is really a strategic pillar for Visa. There are some amazing programs that the executives have put together for women in particular. There's one called Executive Edge, which it's taught by the Berkeley University for some of the Visa senior executives. But the key about that program is that it is not a women leadership program. It's actually a leadership program where only women get invited. So we're changing the conversation. There's also an amazing program called Return to Work, which is for some women who had to take a pause in their career to take care of their families and raise their kids, and is threatening to get back into technology. So Visa offers the training and the opportunity for those women. Some of them are going to be in the exhibit hall presenting. So if you want to hear their testimony, go there. Visa believes in the power of diversity, so it's investing on that. So this session is going to really inspire you and hopefully will make a mark in your company, but also in the community. And I really want to thank you for participating in this session, how to get buy-in to pioneer equity and diversity in your organization. We have an amazing hours in store for you. I am very excited to introduce Lori McKenzie. Lori is an executive director at the Stanford University Clayman Institute for Gender Research. She defines the strategic direction and engages with the community to derive impact with her research. She publishes in numerous outlets, and she also speaks in topics such as blocking bias, women's leadership, and creating effective workplaces. Lori joined the Institute after a 20-year of marketing work at Procter & Gamble, Apple, eBay, PayPal, and Coffee Press. And she has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business and a BA in economics from Berkeley. So please put your hands together to welcome Lori.
Wow, we're leaping all over. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
You want to get the tips on how to advance yourselves and change your organizations? This is the session for that. Now, at the Clayman Institute, we do research on this. So, of course, why I got invited to speak first is to present a little bit of the research to frame the conversation. And there's two sides of the research I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about why change is stuck in organizations and then what we can do as individuals. And we're going to out-cheer them. You up for that? Woo! Got it. And then we're going to talk about individual strategies, and you're going to hear stories from our panelists that are really going to bring all of this to light, because we want to create change now, right? Okay. So why is change so slow? Anyone excited about the women's wave in Congress and in government? I mean, and then you hear the flip side of the story. We're 50% of the population, and there's still a very large gap. Why is change so slow? So people who study this have noted that there has been zero sustainable progress in the past 10 years. If you look at pay equity, it goes up and down a penny. If you look at the percent in Congress, right, it's gone up dramatically, but the percentages haven't gone up. And if you look at things like the percent of women in leadership, we have a 25% drop in the number of women CEOs in the Fortune 500. So why is that? So if you look at the organizational level and you say, well, we've hired more women. We've promoted our first woman VP. We've done these things. Doesn't that show progress? And despite all of that, why don't our overall numbers change? And one of the narratives that prevents us from doing the hard work we need to do is the narrative that we already are a working meritocracy. Therefore, if that woman VP doesn't survive, it's because she didn't have the skills to do so. So if we believe we already are a meritocracy, our organizational functions work, everything's completely fair and equitable, and we see women not rising to the top at the same rate that we enter them in, if we believe we already are a meritocracy, we will do nothing to examine our systems. So at an organizational level, if you're not asking, where are the challenges, where are the issues, and what can we do to unstick them, then unwittingly, you have a conversation that we already are a meritocracy, therefore any gap is due to that person, not due to us as an organization. And in our panel, we're gonna talk about ways to break that down. How can you move beyond the sense that we already are fair to one where we question what we do as a matter of innovation? How do we move there? The second thing we know is that the way we define leadership in most organizations doesn't capture the breadth of what it takes to lead. We often say we want someone who drives results, someone who takes the sales team to the next level. And while we want that, what we're not seeing is those people who take sales to the next level are doing so on a team. And that team is essential to all the results we produce in our organizations. We tend to define success so narrowly that we miss all of what it takes to survive, to thrive, and to take things to the next level. And because we define success so narrowly, we're looking to replicate the exact same person we have here, and we miss seeing that person in all their breadth. So that when someone comes to be considered for leadership and they don't quite have the same brand around them that the current leadership has, we can't see them as having potential. So if you believe you're a meritocracy and you have a narrow definition of success, you could imagine that's the glue that prevents women who we bring in from rising to the top of our organizations. Now we're gonna hear about some best practices. I wanna give you three worst practices. One, if you believe your organization is meritocratic, meaning HR has this handled, I'm good, you, even a well-intentioned woman, are potentially creating inequity in your organization. Two, we know that if you believe, or any manager in your organization believes, that despite all the neuroscience about how the brain works and the fact that we are biased and make errors in how we assess talent, if you and managers in your organization believe that despite all that, I'm objective, we're objective, things will get worse. And the third condition we know that is a worst practice is believing that you are race or gender blind. I don't see women, and I don't see race. I see talent. Anyone who says that is inadvertently contributing to the problem. Now, what do we know works? We're gonna talk about that today, but here are a few things we know works. One, do you really have a handle on the criteria it takes to succeed in your organization? Anything that around the soft skills that's left to a gut reaction, I know it when I see it, is going to be biased. So being clear about what it takes to succeed. If someone says, let's give someone this opportunity to speak in front of this big audience, if you simply ask, great, what's the criteria we're gonna use to pick someone? If you first pick criteria and then give someone an opportunity, research shows you're much less likely to let bias creep in. So becoming an expert at asking the question, great, what's the criteria we're going to use for that decision? That will block bias. The second one is being very clear about the language you use. It turns out the word choices we make are more indicative of what we really value than any formal statement. So even if we say, I value diversity and inclusion, but I only want people from this one really awesome business school in Texas, I've just told people that I really don't want everyone, I only want some ones, right? So the word choices we make, and I'm gonna give you a little rubric to think about. If I made you choose, you're gonna get a promotion, and I made you choose one of these two statements that you think will get you a promotion. Which one will you pick? I'll say the two statements first. I drove sales, I collaborated with the customer. Which one will get you a promotion? I drove sales, raise your hand. I collaborated with the customer, raise your hand. Okay. So we have, I'd say, 60% drove sales, 40% collaborated with the customer. Now, do you think you can drive sales without collaborating with the customer? And do you think if you collaborate with the customer well, you won't happen to also drive sales? But in language, we often pit them against each other. Either you are a collaborator or a driver. And the way I know this is if you look at your LinkedIn profile and you look at the profile of someone maybe a step above you, look at the difference in language that's used. It's not that one is better than the other, but when we aren't thoughtful about this driving language and collaborative language, what happens is we tend to describe women in collaborative ways, men in driving ways, and then when we look for who gets promoted, often it is easier if you're seen as someone who drives sales versus someone who collaborates with the customer. So strategic word choices are important to use for ourselves as individual women, but also to describe the performance of everyone who works for us. Because what we're trying to catch and block is variance. Are we describing the exact same performance for men and women differently, leading to different perceptions of potential for the exact same performance? Okay. So we know meritocracy is what we should strive for, but as a way of debugging what's broken in our organization, not as saying we're fair. Strategically using criteria to evaluate so that bias isn't determining outcomes, criteria is. And then using language in a way that represents people in the same way, not based on gender, race, age, what college you went to, but really thoughtfully describing performance in equal ways. So that's what our research tells us works. It might feel kind of hard. How would I implement that in my workplace? And that's why we have an amazing panel. I'd like to invite my panelists up to have this conversation with us. Please welcome our panelists. And what I'm going to do, instead of introducing them all at once, I'm going to introduce them before I ask them their first question so I can link their bio to the amazing answer they're going to give us. And if you're wondering about ageism, I cannot read my 14-point font without these, so that's why I am outing myself and letting you know that I need reading glasses.
I'm with you, sister.
Yeah. Great. Emily, I'm going to start with you.
Great.
Emily O'Halloran is the digital lead for the Southwest region of Accenture. In her role, Emily helps clients redefine how they serve connected customers and operate connected organizations. Now, the good news about starting with you, Emily, is that Accenture does research on this. And
correct.
So I'd love for you to share your data. Because despite us wanting to create more equity in the workplace, women are still underrepresented, mm-hmm. still face pay inequity for the work they do, and sometimes having some statistics about the differences between men and women in the workforce can help us start a conversation with someone who doesn't realize there still is inequity in the workplace. So Emily, would you please share your data with us?
Absolutely. And you did describe really what the issue is, and it is very much around underrepresentation of women in the workplace at all levels, mm-hmm. and also pay inequity. And so just some of the numbers I'd like to share with you, and these often spur some good conversation, because it's easy to talk about stats, it's harder to talk about why that's
yes.
happening and what mm-hmm. to do about it.
Yes.
So you had mentioned the stat about females in the C-suite, in particular as CEOs. So unfortunately, the number actually has dropped by 25%. And the number has gone basically from 32 CEOs that are females to 24. The next thing to talk about are boards. And corporate board of directors, when you're talking about the Fortune 500, just over 10% are female. So then let's talk about dollars and cents. So for every $100 that a male earns, a woman earns $75. And even when you talk about levels in a company, mm-hmm. If you look at men and women in terms of who is in the management ranks, for every 100 men, In management, there are 34 women. And so, you know, you'd hope, well, gosh, maybe the younger generation is different. Maybe those numbers are different. Unfortunately, they're not. So a couple stats to share about those women and men that are early on in their career in the professional workforce. So within the first 5 years in a career, actually women start to lose pay equity by about 6% just within the first few years of working. When you start to look at women, and even before they get into the professional world, when you look at are they motivated and interested in leadership positions, women are far less interested than men. When you look at mentorship, how many women have mentors versus men, it's far less than men. I could go on and on and on, and this isn't meant to be depressing.
kind of is.
I know. And I've been in the workforce for 23 years, and it is, you had talked about it, it is shocking that the numbers haven't changed. So hopefully it's actually more inspiring than it is depressing.
Okay, are we drawing a line of demarcation today? Yeah. The trend line from today, we will be the ones who make it go like this, okay? That's our pact.
Okay. Well, and from this morning as well, I mean, the amount of funding that, you know, a female entrepreneur gets versus a male. You know,
absolutely.
It's all over.
Now, I love your statistics, but we also know that organizational dynamics don't affect everyone the same, so we're now going to turn to Carol. Mm-hmm. Carol Fulp is the CEO of Partnership Inc., New England's premier organization dedicated to enhancing the competitiveness of the region by developing, retaining, and convening multicultural professionals. Mm-hmm. Here's the good news for you. Carol will be having a book signing after this session. She is the author of Success Through Disruption. Yes, there it is. If you like me can't see because of lack, I will read you the title. Success Through Diversity, How the Most Inclusive Companies Win. Now, Carol, I'd love if you could shed some light on how dynamics might not work the same for women of color in organizations. Would you please help us understand that dynamic?
I'd like to say that when Caucasian woman gets a cold, women of color get pneumonia. Mm-hmm. When I listen to Emily talk about her statistics, and I want to share with you what they are for women of color. And as you talk about the 79 cents on the dollar for Caucasian women, for African American women, it's 63 cents on the dollar. It's 57 cents on the dollar for Native American women. It's 53 cents on the dollar for Latino women. And so it's far more challenging. And so one of the things that is so critical is that we all partner together on this issue, and that women of color partner with our Caucasian sisters to ensure that we are addressing the barriers to success in the workplace. But what I've seen in the workplace is, and I've seen this, what I've seen in the workplace is that males, at the end of the day, don't like giving up their power.
I'm looking for the men in the room to nod. No.
I've seen during the economic crisis, when scarcity occurred, I first have witnessed the power base. The males, I've seen them do this, this, and secure themselves first. That's very natural, right? A natural tendency to secure yourself first when there's a threat. And then I've seen the natural tendency to reach down in the organization and pull up somebody who looks like you, to take care of your tribe. And women, and certainly women of color, are not a part of that tribe. And so we are always going to be the other. And we're always going to be marginalized until we are able to demonstrate how diversity is an asset to business. And what's the business value of diversity? And why diversity is profitable? And that's what the McKinsey study says.
That's right.
That's what the Forbes study say. And so only when we are able to address diversity as a business value, good for business, will we really be able to break barriers. And we are on that path.
Thank you. If you don't know the McKinsey report that Carol's referring to, it's called Women in the Workplace. You can just Google that and go ahead and find it.
Fourth year.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked a little bit about what is the state of women, what are the particular barriers women of color face, and some of us might face barriers because of the careers we're in. So next we're gonna hear from Wendy. Mm-hmm. Wendy Howell is Chief of Staff with Technical Services Product Management at Cisco Systems, with a portfolio responsible for more than $15 billion in revenue.
Oh, I thought it was 60.
Six.
No, just joking.
Inside joke. With my amazing sight, bumped it up just a touch because I can see the future and I know soon it will be $60 billion
there
in revenue. And
forward.
I'll say that I helped motivate that.
There you go.
She is the driving force behind a really amazing partnership between Cisco and Girls in Tech. Girls in Tech is a global nonprofit with over 60 chapters and 60,000. That's where I got the 60 from. 60,000 members. So Wendy, we really know that tech careers are some of the highest paying. Mm-hmm. That when you think of the future, who's designing the Internet of Things, the way that we drive, our cars are now computers. They're being developed mostly by men. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a woman in tech and maybe some of the barriers that women in tech face that might be similar but also unique to what women more broadly are facing.
Yeah, and I think much of it is very similar. The numbers are the same across the board, right? But in technology specifically, you are 9 times out of 10, you're gonna be sitting in a room with a very, very low percentage of women. So that can be a challenge, depending on one's personality style, or it cannot be a challenge if you're like me and you're just a renegade and you don't really care. So I just think that the biggest challenge that I think for technology specifically, I mean, we know the numbers are super high for male versus female, but I'm more worried about the future because of the pipeline. We don't have enough women coming in to interview. Perfect example, I was at Haas Berkeley School of Business doing some interviews, and I had 20 people I interviewed, 2 women. So I think we really need to work on getting more young women interested in technology as a vertical. And I don't mean technology just that you're gonna code. You can be in a technology vertical without coding, but we just have to get more females that are wanting to get into this world. It's just, it's a little bit frightening, you know, when you think about the numbers like that. So.
And we even know from research that even when women do enter the tech field, they're more likely to leave the industry than in any other industry there is. So it's not necessarily women aren't not joining because they're not interested. There's something chilling them out from seeing themselves in the future of technology. Now I wanna next move to some insight about why change might be so slow. So we've kind of laid the groundwork for how it looks, and here we are, this is the 19th year this conference has been in Texas. So we have lots of smart, motivated people, not just women, working on this issue. Why hasn't there been more progress? So let's first turn to Carol. You were talking a little bit about unconscious bias and why that could be some of the reason why.
Definitely. When you think about it, what is said is that women are promoted on performance and men are promoted on potential. You touched upon that. We have to prove ourselves. Men will look at someone and say, they remind me of me, and let me invest in them. But there is this unconscious bias. Let me give you an example of perception of power. A study was done, and the perception of power was that most CEOs would be and are over 6 feet tall with gray hair and angular faces. Because angular means wisdom as opposed to chubby, soft facial structures. Now, just alone, 60% of male CEOs are over 6 feet tall. The unconscious bias says that you're more powerful when you're tall. The reality is that only 15% of the male population is over 6 feet tall. But why do we have such a large population of male CEOs over 6 feet tall? So there's all these perceptions of what power should be, should look like. And power does not specifically look like any of us here and most of you there. And so what we have to do is to help break down that unconscious bias. But we have to do it by not shaming or blaming. At the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that all of us have biases, and that it is important for all of us to check our biases at the door when we come into the workplace, because it is critical that we have, as you've talked about before, that we have diversity of thought around the table in order to get the best ideas, the most creative ideas. If we have people who look like us, if I have people who are just black females, they're only gonna think like me. And I'm not gonna have difference at the table. And I want different, creative thinking. So I want diversity. So you really have to, in order to be competitive, you need the best talent of all kinds. And it's so important to create environments where you're able to create, where you're able to create the kind of culture where the best talent of all kinds can succeed. It's said that when people, no matter who you are, when they feel they can bring their best self to work, they're 30% more productive. So that's a business value. So let us all understand we have biases. That's just how life is. It's how all of us grew up. But in order to be effective executives, effective managers, we have to acknowledge that and leave them at the door and be as objective as possible. Think of it this way. When you have a problem at your home and you have to fix something at your home, you don't go to a toolkit with all hammers.
Good
analogy.
That's
not gonna fix the problem.
I'm late.
I do.
Right?
Yeah.
But you need a diversity of tools in that kit to fix the problem. And that's how we think of diversity. And if you have unconscious bias, you're going to naturally tend to all hammers, if you're a hammer, because that's what you're comfortable with.
Thank you.
Now, do you know if your organization looks at the diversity of your workforce? So how many organizations here know that your organization does? And you have you seen some of the numbers? And so sometimes they're not widely available. So again, to see, are we using all hammers or not? It's really good to know what your numbers are in your organization, and if not, ask for them. That's one thing we can all do, is make sure not only do we count who's there, but if there are, if it doesn't look like what we hope the toolbox does look like, that we are then asking questions about mm-hmm. it. Now, Wendy, you mentioned, you know, change is slow because sometimes you have to take this different role, which you called the renegade. Would you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, just a couple thoughts on the change being slow thing. There's two things that come to my mind. Number one, diversity inclusion. That's a really great, big, fuzzy buzzword or buzz phrase right now. Every larger organization, maybe even mid and small, has a chief diversity officer, chief something officer. But are we really, is every organization really taking that to heart? In other words, is that a figurehead? Mm-hmm. I hate to say that, but I think that there's some organizations mm-hmm. that I tick that box. Mm-hmm. We hired a chief diversity officer, and they're not really doing, you know, taking action. And I think the other thing that is probably very slow with the progress is I look out here. All women, almost. How many men are here? Would you raise hands? So what percentage of that? We need more men to be involved in this conversation and to be allies and sponsors and supporters and mentors. And I would love to see this be 50% men so that we can have a conversation with everyone that's in our organization. I think those are two. And the renegade thing, I'm notoriously impatient, and I just don't believe in asking permission oftentimes. If we need to get something done, let's just go do it. Just get shit done. I mean, right. Just go do it. Sorry. Oh, I swore. I won't say it again.
Now, you heard a little bit of, I think, Carol, you kind of were touching on, like, how do we really bring it outside of a side part of what we do to the center? So, Emily, will you talk about the kind of making it a business priority in organizations?
Yes, sure, absolutely. So it was actually great to see all the hands go up about people who know the numbers in their company and have programs. Actually, this is a better representation of really what the numbers say. So unfortunately, for a number of companies, less than 50% actually have a formal plan about how they're going to address inclusion and diversity as a company. And then when you even get down to more specific questions around how many women are in leadership positions versus men, or even get down to pay, a lot of companies don't have that information. And if they do, they don't publish it within the company. And even if they publish it within the company, they don't necessarily publish it outside the company. And so almost like any objectives that companies set, and companies are really good at this, at, you know, cost reduction objectives or growth objectives, they applied that same vigor to diversity and to inclusion about making people accountable, around setting a plan, around setting goals and tracking against those goals and rewarding people. That same methodology really can be applied in the same way to diversity and inclusion.
That's great. If it is something you work towards and you don't have a plan, it seems pretty hard to get there.
Absolutely.
So you know whether it truly is a business priority if your organization has a plan that's known and people are held accountable to.
Absolutely.
And just because you're... you know, you track how many diverse interviews you do. That's not a plan.
Do you know what I'm saying?
You've got to do something more.
Sounds like a little luck is being intended for
exactly.
that one. Now, let's turn to solutions. We're going to start with what can organizations do, then we're going to move to what can individuals do. So starting with organizations, you know, sometimes looking internal doesn't always inspire change. Sometimes you need to have a partnership. So can you talk about how, Wendy, you've used your partnership with Girls in Tech to motivate change inside of Cisco?
Yeah, so if you think about it, it goes back to what I started with earlier. I'm being very worried about the pipeline, you know, what's coming up. Full bore, I have a 14-year-old daughter, so I'm very passionate about raising the next generation of amazing female leaders. So, you know, I embarked upon this partnership with Girls in Tech, which is global. And actually, I think it's up to 100,000 members now globally.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yes, and I also happen to be the managing director, one of the managing directors for the Austin chapter as well. So, I mean, in order to address the pipeline issue, get out there with organizations that are doing amazing, impactful work around the globe, with events like Hacking for Humanity, Global Classroom, Teaching Coding, Entrepreneurship, which we're doing, a session here in a couple months. It's getting out there and being involved with an impactful organization that has the type of folks that you want to bring into your organization, and then really working with them in a true partnership, not we signed a thing with a nonprofit, so we're really cool at Cisco, but we are very actively involved. We've done over 25 events globally with the organization, so it's going to help us bring more and more young, amazing women into our team.
I love that part you said by connecting it not just as an activity, but as a recruiting tool.
Yes, absolutely.
Research shows that when a woman enters a field that might not be as women heavy, so like technology, and she does an internship before she starts work, she's likely to start at a higher level because people know she's good and are less likely to have the biases about her affected. So I love that idea of using the partnership to break down people's resistance to having young women in tech. So that's fabulous.
And by the way, come and see us at our booth. We'll
yes. So how many people here have booths? So you have a booth,
yes.
You have a booth, and you have a book signing.
And I have a book signing.
So you have plenty of ways to talk afterwards.
Great.
So,
Emily,
I don't mind, I keep talking to asking you for your amazing data, but you getting to equal research, right? And talking about the cultural drivers that create change, would you share some of your insights with us?
Sure. We actually did a very cool study. It was actually a global study. We interviewed or surveyed 22,000 people. And what we were trying to do is break down this problem, right? Why are some companies better at this than other companies? And we kind of took an analytical approach to it. So we basically looked at 200 factors and tried to figure out what influences equality in the workplace versus what doesn't. And we broke that down to roughly 40 that seemed to have an impact, and even further into 14 that materially make a difference. And so those 14 really go across a number of themes. And when you look at the themes, they're not surprising, but it's helpful to think about how your own companies may or may not be doing this. So the first theme is really around bold leadership. So when you look at your leadership team, is somebody taking responsibility, or a few people taking responsibility, to do something different? Are there commitments that are being made? The second is around comprehensive action. So this gets to, do you have policies in place that help to foster this? And interestingly enough, policies just to help women alone actually can be detrimental. So in the examples of maternity leave, when it becomes parent leave, yes, and paternity exactly. leave, it is actually a much different playing field. Mm-hmm. And then even around things like having clothing policies, for example, are detrimental, because often they don't necessarily take into consideration gender differences around dress. And then finally, the last one is around creating an inclusive environment. So do you do things like allow for working out of home, for example, or flexibility of work schedules, or things like that, that really try to create an environment that doesn't kind of advantage or disadvantage any particular gender by creating that environment? And so I want to share a story about Accenture, because we have a CEO of our North American business, and she's the first female CEO, and she came into post a few years ago. And it is amazing, as somebody who's worked for Accenture for 23 years, it's amazing to see the difference that has happened with her appointment as a North America CEO, and with her taking this diversity and inclusion as one of her key objectives. So first, she is our first female CEO. And studies show that when you have somebody in a leadership position, it actually makes a big difference in terms of how many other women are on that fast track when you have somebody in a leadership position. What she also did, which was very new, is she actually understood what our makeup of our company in terms of gender. And she did the unthinkable, especially for a consulting firm. She published it. She made it available. I know. She published it. And we've been doing it for 2 years in a row, and we'll continue to do it. And then she also made a commitment, a bold commitment, that she also shared publicly, is that we will reach gender equality by 2025. And that's a pretty big commitment, because when you just do the math, And you think about what the inequality is and the pace of hiring, and it just mathematically is a tough commitment, much less actually making it happen. And so, it was when I saw the research and then I thought about Accenture as a company, you know, it started to make sense how these cultural imperatives really, really do make a difference.
And talk about a need for a pipeline, huh?
Yes, oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. There's, you know, this idea of a moonshot.
Yeah.
That we're gonna put balloons all over the world so there's connectivity. Why can't gender equality by 2025 be a moonshot?
Yeah. For everybody. Yeah.
For everyone.
Yeah.
So, Carol, I love that you've brought your book because inside of it are amazing stories of what works.
It's my publicist here.
And one in particular you kind of highlighted a little bit to me. Would you share with our audience the story of what Mattel did to create more change?
Thank you. If you would just indulge me. So let me tell you the Mattel story. Toy giant Mattel is another example of a company that catapulted its business forward by appealing to a diverse marketplace. For decades, since its debut in 1959, the Barbie doll, flawlessly thin, high-heeled, and white skin, was a cultural sensation and one of the world's best-selling toys. By the mid-2000s, Barbie's dominance and brand appeal began to lag. After four straight quarters of plummeting sales, Elsa, the doll from Disney's movie Frozen, overtook Barbie as the world's most popular doll in 2014. Mattel's creative team began Barbie's modern makeover because the brand was losing relevance. They chose to design a more inclusive set of dolls that more accurately reflected the size and complexion of America's children, as well as the values of the parents. In 2015, Mattel launched a new generation of dolls, complete with curvy bodies, 23 hair colors, 22 hairdos, 18 eye colors, an array of different skin tones. The product launch, Mattel's most significant rebranding effort to date, has proven revitalizing and lucrative. And parents and children alike flock to the ethnically, racially, and bodily diverse product lines. This new generation of Barbies wouldn't have been possible without a diverse workforce inside Mattel. To help design a culturally sensitive and compelling Black Barbie, for example, the company's marketing team consulted with Mattel's African American ERG group. They helped get the doll's name, skin tone, and hair just right. This was important because consumers roundly criticized the 1967 African American Barbie, colored Francie, for her inauthenticity. Besides having a darker skin tone, she lacked any bodily features or hairstyles typical of African Americans. As African American Tom Burrell, a diversity advertising trailblazer, quipped, "Black people are not dark-skinned white people." A lack of authenticity plagued previous Barbie dolls' efforts as well, with the wheelchair-bound Share a Smile Becky doll lacking the correct proportions to fit into her own Dreamhouse elevator, and the computer engineer Barbie product line in 2014 requiring help from boys to actually code. In 2016, though, Mattel drew on female engineering leaders such as Molly Proffitt, CEO of Kerchunk Games, Julianne Crummett from Entertainment Industries Educator, Chief at Google, and Kimberly Bryan, Founder and Executive Director of Black Girls Code, to help it design a compelling doll that resembled a real tech geek. These women advised Mattel during the design process, ensuring the new career's game developer Barbie was authentic, compelling, and would help inspire a new generation of budding female computer scientists and STEM leaders. Even Barbie's companion Ken received a total diversity makeover. Prior to the new iteration of Ken dolls, Barbie's plastic beau typically sported blonde hair, blue eyes, and a chiseled figure. Revamped Ken comes in one case with a man bun, and while another sports a dad bod, a Fortune article observes. All of this increased diversity has led to more prosperity for the company. Mattel's brunette Latino Barbie with curves and brown eyes became the company's 2016 best seller. Following 4 years of declines with the original Barbie, sales of the new dolls increased 7% in 2016, earning nearly $1 billion for the company, proving that diversity is just good for business.
Thank you. Now, there's two microphones. We'd like to open it up for all your questions. Ask us anything you need to know to create change starting as soon as tomorrow or today. So please line up at the mics, and thank you for coming back to MC this part of our discussion.
Oh, you can also see the Coder Barbie at the Girls in Tech booth.
Just hey.
Saying. Come on now.
Okay, thank you. Could you go first?
Hi. Do you have any recommendations on measuring metrics or KPI with diversity and inclusion participation?
Around what metrics to measure?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, quite frankly, they're just some basic ones, at least out of the gate, which has to do with, first, just look at your workforce. Mm-hmm. How many men and women do you have, if we're talking about gender diversity? Okay. Second has to do with career levels. How many are in management versus not in management? And then, of course, the million-dollar question is about pay. So when you have people doing the same or similar jobs, is there pay inequity or not? So even just starting with some really obvious basics is just a great place to start. And then you sort of measure where are you today, where do you want to be, and have a recurring, you know, dialogue about how you're progressing or not progressing. I think it's a great place to start.
Thank you.
And for individual leaders, you could ask them to list who they're sponsoring in an organization and to look and require them to have a diverse slate of protégés. And you could look to individual managers and look at their progress. So about an individual KPI, you can take these numbers and ask leaders to be accountable for the diversity of their own teams that they're running to.
Please go ahead with the next question.
Thank you so much. I think I'm looking to see if you have some specifics to give me. I'm currently in mid-level management. I chair our women's group, which is great, and we try and do things like we have panels of all women. I always make sure that it is a diverse panel as far as level of experience, tenure, background, race, and ableism and things like that. But at the same time, the title of this session really spoke to me as far as not waiting for the C-suite to do more with diversity in your company. And I'm wondering if there's some specifics that you can provide me as somebody at mid-level management that can, what more can I do to encourage, I'm intentional in my hiring and in the women's group space, but there's still more to do, and I'm hoping you guys might have some more ideas for me.
Do you hire?
I do, and I'm very intentional in that space.
And do you use, or have you encourage your company to use the Rooney Rule, which is very specific, which indicates that whenever you have an opportunity open, mm-hmm. that you ensure you have a diverse slate before you can fill that job.
Okay.
So that we're not telling you who to hire, but the job cannot be filled unless a diverse slate of candidates is seen by the hiring manager. And just having that process will wind up increasing your diversity hires.
It's the Rooney?
The Rooney Rule.
Okay, thank you very mm-hmm. much.
And I would also take what you're doing and go find more yous and yeah. spread it across the company.
Okay.
Well, one other thing too, I was actually part of a leadership team and we'd met in New York and we heard from some of our ERGs, employee resource groups, about what made it difficult for them working within Accenture, the African-American ERG, the Hispanic ERG, and the women's ERG. Mm-hmm. And hearing from individual people about their experiences and what they're running into is amazing. Wonderful. So many people at leadership positions have no clue. So if you have created this group, finding a chance for them to interface with leadership, to mm-hmm. share experiences, both good and bad, I think will open up people's eyes. Oftentimes, I don't think it's purposeful what people are doing. It's
sure.
just lack of understanding and awareness. So if you
right.
can create that connection between what you've built and your leadership, I think it could be very powerful.
Thank
and
you.
And sure. if I can add to that, the trend now is to move from ERGs to BRGs, business resource groups, mm-hmm. so that executives, just like this case, where the employees added value to the business issue. And so the business problems are then brought to the group. And so the group becomes essential to the company in terms of the business. And so you may want to even look at, you know, changing the format to a business resource group.
Thank you all very much.
Please go ahead.
I know that sometimes when organizations and companies support initiatives to diversify their pool of people, that a lot of times the onus falls on the very few women that do exist within that organization to lead that effort. And I guess, how do we make sure that it's not all on the C-level, but it's also not on all just the women leaders to make this stuff happen, because they're already struggling with a lot of things.
I love this idea of moving it out of an employee resource group to a business resource group. So if it's clear what the business case is to recruit, let's say, more women out of a certain demographic or out of a certain university, that if it's a business case, you would allocate it to the business leader. Now, sometimes people say it's great to have a woman on a recruiting team because she asked the question that block bias. Well, why can't we teach the men how to ask those same questions to block bias? So I think it's moving it out of a for inclusion only reason to really the business case, and then look for the good behaviors that you expect women to enact. Maybe ask more questions about what excites you about here versus making people prove that they measure up. How can you teach all the people in an organization to enact those good behaviors, not just the women, and share the burden of being inclusive?
Thank you.
And another point, I've always found it's helpful to co-chair.
I shouldn't say that.
So that you have a male co-chair and a female co-chair. And there's so much learning that goes on there. And I indicate that, you know, when you have a business issue, you put your best business team on it. And so if diversity is important, put your best business team on it. And in this particular case, why not select a male executive and a female executive to co-chair this initiative?
And take that same approach down to the working level team as well, not just the executive sponsors, I think.
Gotcha, thank you.
We only have time for one question. Do you want? Sorry about that.
Okay. My question is a focus on increasing the pipeline of diversity. Right now, I'm leading a strategy inside my organization to increase that pipeline, but all the focus usually is in young talent or in recent grads. That's like, well, I'm a millennial saying this, but but you know, what about the professionals? Like, what else can we do? Like, I want to target executives. I want to target hiring managers or professionals out there that are diverse. What else can we do? We go to campus to hire. We have employee resource groups, but what else? You know, what is your recommendation? I work in a tech company. You guys are from tech companies too. So just want to hear from you. What's your thought on that?
Well, if you're targeting maybe mid-career folks, it sounds like, and even executives as well, I would be out in the community of other like-minded tech companies, whether it's a product management meetup or, I mean, you can't swing a cat in Austin without there being some sort of meetup for something. So get out there, and I think networking outside your own walls is one of the most powerful things you can do.
Okay.
There are also groups like Black MBAs, Prospanica for Latina MBAs,
yes,
that are specifically targeted towards that level, and networking with them the same way you would network with a university group is also a way to increase the people you touch.
Okay, great. Perfect.
So this has been very inspirational. Before you leave, we'd like to hear 2 to 3 things that you want us to take away. If you want us to be that driver of change within an organization, what are the 2 to 3 things that you would say to all of us?
I would say start a business resource group.
Is there a mic off?
Can you hear me now?
Do you want to stand up at the podium just to make sure we can hear you?
That's weird. Like, I'm right.
I would say start a business resource group. It has the opportunity to advance your issue, but also it has the opportunity to identify, here is why diversity is good for business. It's called a business resource group, so it's about business rather than employees. And you will find executives tend to embrace that more because it's advancing the business.
We're going in order? So I think, from my perspective, don't think that all change has to come from the top. In fact, I think the more impactful change can come from even the individual contributor level. So plan a networking with a purpose event. Find a tribe of people that think like you and want to address whatever it is that we're addressing, inclusion, collaboration, et cetera. And put your Nikes on and just do it. Like, start somewhere. Go get a lot of like-minded people, and you can make impactful change.
I would say start by empowering yourself. There is so much out there to learn and so many people that want to be mentors. So find somebody in your business who inspires you, or you think does something different and better than you do, and ask him or her to lunch. Just start very simple. And every week, just try to learn a little bit something new from somebody or some great article. And technology is the key to a lot of good paying career opportunities. So don't forget that.
And I would just say, has anyone heard of the 70-20-10 rule of career development? So 70% of your career development is the specific experiences and skills you have. 20% are your critical relationships, and 10% are the educational tools that you have. We are often negligent of the 70%. Are we actively seeking stretch assignments, stretch opportunities to gain the visibility and skills we need to advance, and making sure that our colleagues, if we're a mid-level manager, our employees, are equally having access to the opportunities to gain the visibility and confidence to be promotable, so that we are building a diverse bench of potential leaders in our organization at all times, both for ourselves and the others who are like us in our organizations.
Thank you. So my commercial in the Exhibit Hall.
Advertising.
Visa is sponsoring the Career Pavilion, so come and hear from wonderful speakers as well there. I really want to thank you on behalf of Visa and the Texas Women Conference. It has been an amazing speech. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.